I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. The use of new media, particularly by young people, challenges conventional wisdom in many fields: education, social engagement, civic participation. Our guests today have been studying new media and how they may change our most familiar habits and institutions. Doug Thomas is associate professor in the Annenberg School of Communication at the University of Southern California. Mimi Ito is a cultural anthropologist working in Japan and the U.S. Together, they'll give us an inside look at new media and their effects. Today on Smart City, but first, the news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Doug Thomas is associate professor in the Annenberg School of Communication at the University of Southern California. His book, Hacker Culture, provided a detailed firsthand account of the computer underground. Doug's current projects include a new book, Reinventing Technology: Cultural Narratives of Technological Change. I know that, of course, your work in technology must suggest some new ideas about what learning could look like and how it could take place unattached or differently attached to schooling. Could you talk about that a little bit?
My work recently has been motivated by interactions with a colleague of mine who's the Annenberg Center now and used to be the director of the Palo Alto Research Center at Park, John Seely Brown. We started talking about some of the things that we saw going on in the virtual world, particularly around games, and the ways in which we saw new forms of learning starting to emerge. And his primary interest when he came to me to talk about this was that he felt like our schools today weren't necessarily preparing students for the jobs of the 21st century, which he sees as really being about innovation, different ways of thinking, existing and working within worlds of possibility rather than certainty, and so on. And I said, wow, that sounds a lot like what happens in the games that I'm studying, you know, both with kids and adults. So we started thinking through what some of the things might look like in terms of, as you mentioned, sort of learning objectives, learning goals, and so on. We started to think that there's some things that traditional modes of learning are pretty good at. Transferring information, it's pretty hard to beat a book. So we started to think differently about that question. And what we found, games in particular are very good at, especially multiplayer games and what are called massively multiplayer online games like World of Warcraft or City of Heroes or Star Wars Galaxies, is that they tend not to be necessarily the best way to transfer concrete or discrete pieces of information. What they're extremely effective at is setting what we call dispositions. And dispositions are kind of outlooks toward certain ways of knowing, certain ways of interacting with other people, reading social cues, understanding the ways in which other people share and exist in a space with you. And we thought if that becomes a model for understanding education, then we start to get some really different ways of measuring outcomes. So rather than asking the question, can a game teach math? That's an empirically verifiable question, and we can probably find out it does, maybe in some ways better than other methods, maybe in some ways worse. But the question for us that was far more important is, at the end of playing a certain game, will a kid love math? Will he or she then be disposed to want to ask the kinds of questions that mathematicians ask? Will they look at the world in the way that a mathematician looks at the world? And those kind of things, I think, are incredibly powerful. So if you were to go to a teacher and have their students play a game that taught the multiplication tables and taught it really well, or one that made them love math and want to do math for the rest of their lives, it's pretty clear what most teachers would pick, at least I would hope.
Is there some substitute, Doug, for games? In other words, are there other methods, and perhaps not what's being offered today in classrooms by teachers, but are there other methods that you think would accomplish the same end result?
Yeah, I do. And games is, for me, a very complicated term because it refers to a wide array of different things, everything from soccer to, you know, online virtual worlds to chess and checkers. So the way I like to think of it is, instead of thinking of learning from a game or even learning in a game, that I tend to think of the dichotomy that we have between words like play and work or play and learning. and that my experience has always been, and I think most people have had this experience too, that you can learn an incredible amount of stuff through play, and that we spend too much time trying to enforce the barrier between those two things rather than trying to break it down. So we see games as one of the spaces in which that happens naturally. So it suggests to us a pretty good place to explore that question. But it's certainly not something that can't happen in other forums. And we're kind of looking in terms of the digital space around more broadly what we would call virtual worlds, which would be spaces like Active Worlds or Second Life or other places that don't necessarily have a game component to them, but that allow people to explore social spaces together, usually in a kind of embodied avatar-like form.
What if, let's take something that is non-digital, like real-life problem solving. It's still motivated by winning, not necessarily competitive winning, but solving a problem and solving a real problem, so there's intrinsic value to it. Does that deliver a similar result?
I think it does, but again, our focus has been, whether it's virtual or the real classroom, real-world classroom, or any other form of learning, even the corporate workplace, the two things that we really try to push people toward is understanding those kind of phenomenon as problem spaces rather than problems, meaning that there are certain conditions which allow for solutions to emerge, allow some solutions to work better than others, and so on. And being acutely aware of what the conditions of the problem are oftentimes allow you to change those conditions, either to make the problem disappear or to make it solvable in other ways, or to, you know, turn it from a problem into a benefit.
Can you give me an example?
If you think about a really big problem that seems intractable, something like Arab and Israeli conflict, if you think about that as a problem and a question of who's right and who's wrong, who should win, who should lose, what the outcome should be, then you're limited to a very small set of acceptable solutions. If you start to think of it as a problem space, if you think about it as a situation where there's conflict over religion, there's a conflict over territory, there's a conflict over ideology, and you start to ask yourself, what kind of things can we do to understand those historical, deeply rooted conflicts that are not about simply dividing the space up, moving the lines, or declaring one religion superior to the other? Then you can start to say, okay, how do we educate the other side about what it's like to be in the shoes of the other? And from there, you start to get the possibility of a kind of understanding which allows for much more complicated and much more nuanced solutions. So I think the argument we would make is that it's a kind of first step to understanding what the problem actually is. Instead of starting from the solution, you start from the problem and try to expand the possibilities as much as you can.
Can you think about that as it would apply to learning today?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think that one of the things that we need to teach kids, and one of the things we need to kind of value and celebrate, is that they are problem solvers. That's fundamentally what the process of learning is for us. And unfortunately, in a lot of ways, schools don't honor that process. They don't start from a position where they assume kids have any kind of expertise or teach them in terms of things that are already relevant to their lives. They like to have a model which says there's knowledge out here and we need to get it inside the kid.
Mm-hmm.
Right? How do we do that? So it becomes, again, that kind of question of transfer. How do we transfer the knowledge from outside to inside? Rather than starting with the kid and saying, okay, what are the things that make this kid want to learn? And how do we use those to reconceptualize our notion about what education needs to look like? Especially today when the practices of learning in everyday life are changing at such an incredible rate. So, you know, there needs to be attention to things like social networking, instant messaging, cell phone usage, MySpace, all of those kind of things that are part of kids' daily lives that tend to be bracketed off from school or other formal systems of instruction.
Where do you see teachers fitting in to that same construct?
This is a really interesting question. I see two things happening in terms of that. The first is that teachers provide a really fundamental role for what we would call scaffolding. That is giving kids and adults and everybody else the necessary materials they need to make sense of the world. So there are certain pieces of information that are communicated effectively and should be communicated by having somebody sit down and tell you or show you or give you a book or lecture or those kind of things. there's certain learning that doesn't require creative input on the part of the learner. Mm-hmm. Learning the alphabet, that's an okay thing to learn by singing a song and, you know, and just getting this knowledge repeated to you over and over again. Vocabulary works that way. I mean, we have a lot of things that for a long time have worked well that way. So teachers need to be there to do that. The second thing that teachers need to do, and I say this from an incredible personal experience I had, was in some ways to learn to get out of the way. I'll tell you my experience, which was I taught a class in a game called Star Wars Galaxies with undergraduates. And my original class started off as a 3-hour seminar where for the first hour and a half I would lecture, and then for the next hour we would do a kind of question and answer session. And for the last half hour, they would do a show and tell of all the things they had found in the game that week, which illustrated the course concepts. About the second or third week, they started coming in and saying, I know we got to do the lecture, I did the reading, it's all very interesting, but before we do that, I just have to show you this really cool thing. So we'd look at those things, and we'd do some of the lecture and so on. By about the fifth week, we were doing 3 hours of show and tell. And my students were saying, you're not going to believe this. Judith Butler's talking about this notion of gender and blah, blah, blah. And I found this thing. You've got to go see it, right? So they're reading the readings through the game rather than the game through the readings, which is absolutely fascinating. And I would come home after this class and say to my wife, who's also a professor, I'm a complete fraud. I'm teaching them nothing. Because I wasn't lecturing anymore. I wasn't instructing. I wasn't, you know, providing that knowledge. And then when we got to the midterm exam, these kids, who were not the smartest kids I've probably taught, maybe not even the hardest workers, wrote the best midterm exams I've ever read, bar none. And they said to me, we didn't want people to think we were just playing games. They really, really worked hard. But I had to learn how to get out of the way of the kids, because they were learning. They were doing it on their own, and they were coming up with examples from this game for these readings that I never in a million years would have thought of. And they were quite brilliant, most of them. So I think teachers have to reconceptualize their roles once again in terms of questions of possibility. And they also have to be aware when students are floundering, how to get them back into that world, how to engage their imaginations, how to do those sorts of things.
Can you imagine, Doug, what the first step would be, particularly at younger ages?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the great thing, is that kids at younger ages have no difficulty playing. They haven't learned that they're not supposed to do that yet. So I think that's a great time to get them to embrace that connection between those things.
But what about the teachers?
There's a kind of funny story about this, too. When I was back in graduate school, I did a thing called T-groups as part of small group communication. And nobody really knew what was going on, as you kind of don't. And everybody's going through all these processes, and we're studying our processes. And it's very intense. For 2 weeks, we're meeting 8 hours a day. And at the end, we had this long debriefing. You sort of realize that part of the goal of this is to learn that boundaries are flexible things and that people can discuss what those boundaries are and what's meaningful to them, and they can decide to go off topic, and that groups can do really powerful, amazing things when they, you know, embrace the process and so on. Most people get this. The one group, without exception, who always fails to grasp this, no matter how long you work with them and no matter how much you tell them, are elementary school teachers. Because in order to structure the classroom at that level, it seems like to me they have a systematic need to control, to discipline, and to regulate the behaviors of the kids. And I'm sure part of that's necessary. I can't imagine, you know, 36-year-olds or 7-year-old kids running around in a classroom. I mean, you can't sort of say, okay, kids, just have at it. But I remember my own experience was, you know, walking to the auditorium, learning how to walk in a straight line, how to carry my chair, certain times head down on the desk for nap time, whatever it was, the flicking of the lights to get us all to be quiet. I mean, this is the period in which we learn all of the kind of disciplinary norms of what it means to be a student. And those things aren't fun. They're not playful. They're not engaging. They're all about controlling yourself in an environment where you want to be doing something else. And then, of course, you know, every 3 hours we let them run around on the playground until they're exhausted for a half hour to try to get that out of their system and call it, you know, recess. So I think that's one of the places you start, is you start thinking about the systems of regulation that are in place and what it means to really turn a kid into a student.
I'm trying to think how you hold on to what is valuable from what we have today and move toward something new, something different, something that you see as being more valuable to the world of work and the world of citizenship going forward.
Yeah.
Can you imagine how you begin taking those steps? I think about the way in which teachers are educated, the way in which schools are organized, the way in which children are measured, all of which would conspire to prevent these kinds of changes.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's a great lesson to be learned right now about standardized testing, which I think most people in education right now want to point to as the root of all evil. And I think that's a mistake. I'm a product of standardized testing. Every year we had, I think, Iowa tests. I remember the phrase. I have no idea what they meant. We didn't get prepared for them. We didn't have intensive study sessions. We just took them and sort of went on and got a report later sent to our parents saying we were in the, you know, 78th percentile of something. It didn't really matter. But I guess it was useful in terms of figuring out what schools were performing well and what weren't. But it didn't seem to affect things too dramatically. The SATs did more so, and the GREs did even more than that. What we're seeing now is, I think, one of the great lessons of something that I think we need to be teaching, which is laws of unintended consequences. I don't think anybody sat down to say, we need standardized testing so we can completely overwhelm the system and drive out art and music. I don't think anybody had that agenda, even if that's what happened in a lot of our schools. So this is another area where I think teaching for the future, it becomes incredibly important for students to understand not only what entails from decisions they make and activities they engage in, but that there's a huge amount of unintended consequences for most of the kind of things that we engage with. Not necessarily learning how to avoid them, but learning how to understand that that's part of the process. And again, if I go back to games, which is sort of my hobby horse, if you haven't guessed, right? games, because they're replayable and because they have very few real-life consequences, can actually be a great way to teach laws of unintended consequences, because you can play the same situation over and over again and see how your decisions play out immediately as well as down the road. You know, if you play a game like SimCity, for example, and you save money not building firehouses, that's great for the next 3 years until a major fire hits downtown and all of your high-income districts burn down because you don't have enough firehouses. It's a lesson about short-term and long-term payoffs, benefits, and so on. And if students can learn those kind of things rather than about building firehouses and stuff from games, I think that that becomes another powerful sort of tool. But I think evaluation right now of students is really tough. Right now, in a mode of standardized testing, the one thing you don't measure is difference. And by all indications, the thing that is going to make people the most successful in the future in business is innovation or thinking differently. So we're kind of, you know, as John Seely Brown likes to say, you know, we're marching forward, preparing our kids for jobs of the 20th century. And in some ways, that's always been what education has done. It's lagged far behind.
Although we certainly have a much more demanding curriculum for students today. So it may be the methods prepare them for Taylorism, but the content, it in an odd way, prepares them for jobs that they will probably never have. I mean, it's like higher math. Few people use it, but certainly not the number of students that are taught it.
Yeah, it's just things seem to be out of balance. And my next-door neighbor is a third-grade teacher in Englewood. And he tells me these horrible stories about being called into the principal's office for, quote-unquote, sneaking art into the curriculum.
Ooh, sneaking art into the curriculum.
Absolutely. And, you know, we can't have that. There's just not enough time. And these kids need to be ready to have their reading scores higher and their math scores higher, and the rest of it just doesn't matter. From what he says, I get the sense that there's a lot of really committed teachers, especially younger teachers who are very idealistic, who are pushing back against this. But they're fighting their own institutions. You know, if you want to teach music, there's no money for instruments for kids and so on. You know, in a weird way, what's more closely connected to something like math than music, right? I mean, it's sort of the artistic expression of mathematics in a weird way. But nobody's going to make that connection because they're not going to have the experience.
Well, if educators really believed that, in fact, there were a connection between math and music, and they're driving so hard to improve their math scores, don't you think they would be using music?
Well, we're back to the problem of direct transfer versus imagination. And there is no direct transferable connection between mathematics and music. I cannot tell you that, you know, if you learn to play Beethoven, you will be able to do algebra. But I can ask you to kind of go on a journey with me where I talk about things like scales and meter and rhythm, and you can start to see how that becomes a way of expression and thinking. And you can also then start to look at mathematics as a series of equations which explain things like rhythm. And I can show you a sine curve and say, do you see any connection between this and what happens when you pluck a guitar string? And we can make those kind of connections through the process of imagination. But there is no one-to-one correspondence between the two. But if somebody loves music, my guess is with the right kind of education, you can get them to love math too. But that's a hard sell. How do you measure that? Right? Which is always the question we come back to.
Doug, thank you so much.
It is my pleasure.
Doug Thomas is associate professor in the Annenberg School of Communication at USC. After a short break, we'll return to talk with cultural anthropologist Mimi Ito about how young people are using new media to make social connections. Smart City is made possible by the generous support of Memphis Urban Innovators, a collaboration of Memphis business leaders, including the Memphis Tourism Foundation of the Convention and Visitors Bureau, who are focused on bringing smart people, smart ideas, and smart solutions to Memphis and the new economy. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. This week on Smart City, we introduce a new segment on the world of urban planning, design, and development from our friends at PlanEdison.com.
For more than a year, high gas prices have been giving most American drivers something to continually complain about. But for the same reason, many transit users have a reason to smile. The Economist reports that rising fuel costs are pushing many cities to invest or reinvest in public transportation, such as light rail and bus rapid transit. Many cities have quickly approved plans to develop brand new light rail systems from scratch. Other cities, such as Denver, Dallas, and St. Louis, are expanding their existing systems on old railway tracks. And some bus systems are adapting to an increased demand by changing their technology to run on cleaner-burning natural gas or even cooking oil. In Atlanta, where getting around the city has been a headache for decades, public transit is moving back into the radar of the community. Plans are underway to transform an old railroad right-of-way into a greenbelt of public park space, hiking trails, and public transit routes. According to the New York Times, the city of Atlanta has already started buying up land in the 22-mile loop. It has plans to build up more than 28,000 housing units scattered along transit corridors that will eventually connect 40 of the city's public parks. Many public transportation advocates hope that increasing transit options and transit-oriented development will get more people riding buses and trains to work. But cheap housing prices over the last couple of years have made it seem economical for many to live a little bit farther away from the workplace. For some, however, that just a little bit farther has stretched into hundreds of miles, sometimes crossing state borders, as reported recently by the Los Angeles Times. Dubbed sleepover commuters, this growing group of self-employed and contract workers, such as nurses and hairdressers, are living farther and farther away from work for the opportunity to own a home. In cities like San Francisco, large numbers of long-distance commuters are creating a market for commuter rooms, small living quarters rented out for a week at a time or less. Though the housing boom in America is showing signs of slowing, a 23-year-old Florida man is striding ahead of market forces to build truly affordable homes. The Bradenton Herald reports that construction company president Chris Moskowitz is using a method to build homes selling under $175,000, an almost extinct price tag in Florida. To make it happen, Moskowitz has to obtain zoning variances that allow him to build smaller homes on smaller lots for a smaller price. This unconventional method is making many lower-income residents into homeowners for the very first time, and Moskowitz hopes that his is a method other home builders will start to use. And finally, a new report published by Livable Places, a Los Angeles-based nonprofit, refutes a claim that L.A. is more dense than New York City. The report, written by three UCLA urban planning students, shows with maps and statistics that New York actually has the higher density. The analysis that concluded Los Angeles is denser than New York has a major flaw, the authors argue. because it relies on calculations of each city's, quote, urbanized area, an ambiguous and imprecise designation. The report's authors claim that using more reasonably defined boundaries, like city limits, will reveal the true densities of cities and offer a more realistic comparison. This is Nate Berg for Planetizen.
Nate Berg is assistant editor for Planetizen.com. Mimi Ito is a cultural anthropologist who studies new media use, particularly among young people in Japan and the U.S. She is co-editor of Personal, Portable, Pedestrian, Mobile Phones and Japanese Life from MIT Press. Mimi has worked for the Institute for Research on Learning, Xerox PARC, Tokyo University, the National Institute for Educational Research in Japan, and Apple Computer. Mimi, how are kids using digital media today?
Well, the first thing that I like to stress is the fact that the use varies tremendously, so that there's a lot of times when we talk about digital media use among young people, we're talking about the very high-end users that are doing the most innovative kinds of uses. But one of the things that's interesting right now is that it's entering kids' lives at all kinds of different levels, so that it's actually the differentiation in kinds of usage that is as interesting as sort of the new cutting-edge uses. At one level, there's this very widespread uptake of technologies like mobile phones, gaming consoles, that are fairly pervasive across, at least if we're talking about U.S. culture, that's leading to a shift in sort of the basic modes of communication and the use of interactive technologies becoming more central. So you see this in, things as simple as young people having mobile phones that they can contact each other without the restraints that they used to have on telephone communication and on gathering in real space. And then with gaming consoles, which is probably a more democratic technology right now than personal computer-based interactive technology, I think we're seeing entertainment shifting to this more interactive mode overall. And you see this even with things like Pokemon or Yu-Gi-Oh!, these kinds of media that are being introduced relatively early, in early childhood, where kids are being invited to remix and trade and traffic in cultural mass media content in a way that they didn't in the past. And then I think at the higher end, when you're getting with older kids and kids with access to more expensive technologies, you're seeing a lot of what is being taken up in the press, like the use of MySpace and Facebook, viral video, things that require, fairly high-end computers and internet connectivity and a high degree of media literacy. And these kinds of practices, I think, are interesting and different because they're enabling young people to not only produce digital media more easily than they were able to in the past, but also to circulate it among their peer groups and use it as sort of a common currency in how they socialize with one another.
You mentioned using media to substitute for gathering. Talk about the relationship between the use of media and gathering in real time, real place.
In a way, there's kind of competing tensions. I think that with kids that have internet-enabled computers, then gathering in virtual spaces or using social networking sites can function in a mode that's similar to how they can interact in public or semi-public spaces where they can meet up with their friends as well as have sort of a somewhat broader, less differentiated audience that they're performing in. You know, you see this with MySpace, the use of public profiles in MySpace and things like that. But we're also seeing, say, with elementary age children, they might use an online space like RuneScape or Club Penguin. These are multiplayer games you can access for free. They use this as sort of a after-school gathering spot. So instead of saying, okay, we'll meet you, in the park at 4 o'clock, they can say, well, we'll see you on RuneScape later. So there are these modes where kids can get together with one another in a peer-based setting that doesn't have to be completely managed by parents and, you know, still have some degree of autonomy, even though they may not have the autonomy to be able to gather with their friends on their own in physical space.
As you've observed behavior, do you find behavior that runs contrary to what we generally believe about kids and new media? You've mentioned one thing, and that is that it's more differentiated than we probably acknowledge.
Yeah, that's one thing that I feel sometimes gets lost in the public debate, is the fact that different kids engage very differently, and that they're, as the higher-end uses move higher, so now it's not just text-based exchange, but it's audio and video, and you really need a pretty decent computer to be able to fully participate in these online worlds, that as that bar gets raised, the barrier to access gets even higher. So that's one issue, and that often when we talk about these things, we're not acknowledging the more accessible uses, like the use of mobile phones and video game consoles and things like that, that also exhibit some of the characteristics that are being celebrated about new media use, but not all of them. I think the other is, you know, what tends to happen, I think, in the public debate is that it does get differentiated between sort of good uses that are really celebrated, the sort of idea of digital kids and how creative and activists they are, and mostly that is about the use of internet and personal computers and the sort of bad stuff that goes on that tends to get associated with sort of commercial media, particularly video games. And that, in fact, they're really, I really see them as part of sort of the same ecology of media change that's shifting overall, except there's a lot of, especially within the U.S. context, the way we talk about these media is very much implicated with class distinction and things like that, and what we consider good and bad media for children. Historically, there have always been these differences, like books have been considered good media, where television have been considered bad media by the middle class or upper middle class. And the same thing is happening in the case of digital media, too, where video games are sort of the site of problems about sex and violence and things like that. And, you know, the more celebrated uses tend to be associated with higher-end technologies that are more closely associated with the educated middle class.
What can we conclude about how learning takes place from observing how kids use new media?
Yeah, well, one of the things that we're trying to understand and we're researching in the work we're doing is the properties of learning when it's driven by young people as opposed to adult-guided agendas. So a lot of these case studies that we're developing have to do with communities that organize on the internet or around special interests surrounding media, like media fandom and things like that, that have adult participation but also have strong youth participation. But the adults are not producing an educational agenda for young people. Young people are engaging on their own terms and because they want to engage with this content. So we're wondering what properties of learning exist in those kinds of settings that differ from traditional educational settings where the agenda is sort of preset by adults and young people are asked to follow that agenda. And I think in the context where it's the young people's peer culture that is primarily driving what's happening in that space, that learning has very different properties.
And what are some of those properties? Have you begun to narrow that down or get a fix on it?
Yeah, I mean, there's a few things. One is, the most obvious is the motivational structure, that kids are being motivated not by sort of future-oriented rewards of or external evaluation by adults, but rather by their own interests in that space. The other thing that's quite interesting is how evaluation works, how assessment and of learning or achievement works in these spaces. And when you don't have an external body or adult assessing the products in that space, then what we're seeing is that there's sort of emerging peer cultures of how you rate each other's work and assess each other's work that are quite interesting. So in those contexts, it's less framed as a system of achievement or achieving particular grades or goals or things like that, and more about how do you build a reputation. And that has a very different structure for how sort of learning and motivation happens than when you're trying to accomplish something because of the hope of a grade or a test score or something like that.
And thinking about how you build a reputation, interesting topic, which I can imagine could work in a very positive way for learning the right things, if you will, and working perhaps in a negative way. So how do you observe that working toward the goal of building a reputation as being positive or negative?
I think it definitely can cut both ways. So we've seen some communities that are very specific to certain cultural products. For example, I'm doing a case study of a particular video production community, and they use their website as a way of rating and critiquing each other's work in very sophisticated ways. And I think in that case, the reputation is really built around the skills that a particular creator is exhibiting, and the online infrastructure facilitates people finding each other's work, commenting on each other's work. And sure, there are sort of issues even with that, where some people feel like it's only the kids who have a lot of friends who get really good ratings. But overall, I think the system is quite interesting in that it enables peer-based evaluation, something that you don't really see in the classroom very often. You don't see other students evaluating other work, each other's work, and that becoming the standard. So that's one case where I think it works fairly well. I mean, the other systems are like probably what a lot of people have seen, like the eBay or Amazon marketplace ratings, where you can see how many transactions a person has had and how highly rated they are by the customers, which is a really nice thing considering when we walk into traditional retail, we don't really know what the consumer experience has been in that space. I think where it can work not as positively is when it's really about the individual and popularity within a peer network, and that there's no real thing that is being evaluated, but rather it's about the person and networking within that space. And that mode of how young people evaluate each other, the peer cultures of young people, have always been fairly brutal. But it makes that kind of peer politicking more visible when you can actually see it online and trace people's social networks and things like that. And so it's not that I think that that's bad, but I think that that's probably not so different from how kids have negotiated peer cultures in the past, and how popularity works among teens and things like that. I think when you look at, say, fan fiction communities or video production communities, youth media that is sort of youth-driven and evaluated online, then you're seeing something that's somewhat different from the opportunities that young people have had in the past for peer reputation building.
Are there aspects of how kids use new media that stand in the way of learning, in your opinion?
Well, I think part of what's worrisome is it seems like there is a risk of a growing disconnect between how kids engage with knowledge and culture outside of formal education and within the schools. So I think one problem is that, you know, there's kids that can become alienated from formal educational structures because they're engaged in these more, you know, interactive and activist environments outside of school, and that schools, I think, are struggling to try to figure out what the right interface is. And that's historically been the case with popular media in general in relation to schooling, that there's always been some effort to try to acknowledge popular culture within the school environment, but there's always been a tension there. I think as kids find these out-of-school settings more compelling and more central to their identities and culture and knowledge, that tension might get more exacerbated.
It seems that the popular culture is so much more compelling today than it has been, say, with television or with earlier forms of popular culture, that educators seem increasingly compelled to try to learn lessons from popular culture and its tools and how to draw those into the classroom or to change the classroom in a dramatic way. Do you think there's the opportunity to do that?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, we're not really in the phase right now where we're making recommendations for educational practice. But I think in the best of all possible worlds, there would be more crossover between what young people are doing outside the classroom and inside the classroom. And there should be a lot of opportunities for it. Although I have to say, at least what I see sort of in the popular debate is those boundaries seem to be getting more reified, like the current controversy over MySpace seems particularly unproductive in trying to get adults in authority positions and educational institutions to engage with what's happening in these spaces as opposed to try to shut them down. I'm a little bit worried about that, but I think there's so much potential there that maybe we can find ways in that are actually work with the educational missions of schools. The other thing is to try to consider how public education could be considered more broadly as something that doesn't just happen in schools, that there are a lot of other institutions, whether that's libraries or after-school programs or just engaged parents, community groups, and things like that. And historically, we've always had that in-between space where adults are interfacing with young people, but in settings that aren't really oriented towards formal evaluation or achievement. And I think the online space, there is the potential for that space to become broader if we do it right. And a lot of the communities we're studying online actually have a lot of adult participation, and adults are in leadership roles together with young people. Part of what we're trying to do, as well as some of the other initiatives that colleagues working in this space are doing, I think simply translating the idioms of like gaming or online communication to a classroom environment, that I think is, you know, it's one model that people have pursued for quite some time, and I know that there are still efforts in that space. I think that's definitely something worth pursuing as sort of an ongoing effort to change the core of educational practice. But I think the way that our research will probably more directly inform this space is by considering environments outside of the school that can be in this more interface zone that can hopefully impact kids' identities and sense of empowerment around knowledge production and cultural production, ways that will have a productive impact on their identities in school, but maybe not a direct translation of these things for a classroom curriculum.
You are an anthropologist. While technology can change very rapidly, people do not typically change as quickly. What changes do you see occurring in us as a result of using these technologies?
You know, I'm not a psychologist, so it's hard for me to talk in terms of individual behavior so much, but I think that, you know, there's usually about a 10-year cycle where, you know, new technology is introduced and there's sort of early adoption and a lot of debate, and then it settles into certain patterns. I think with the mobile phone, we're kind of in a settling phase for how it's being used by young people in a lot of different parts of the world. And it's changed the sense of accessibility, the pervasiveness of social communication in our everyday lives. I think that shift has been quite profound. The other shift in sort of fundamental communication and social behavior that we're looking at right now in the work that we're doing is the dominance of visual communication as sort of an everyday communication and sharing modality. So we've had oral communication and textual communication in this space for quite some time now, but it's only been in the past 3 to 5 years that you're seeing the exchange of photos and really recently videos as part of just what young people use to communicate and to display their identities to each other. And that is sort of a gradual shift towards richer and dynamic media becoming part of how we communicate with one another.
Does physical space become more or less important in this technology-fueled, networked world?
I think physical space becomes differently important. So in one sense, there's these competing tensions between, say, more immersive online experiences that really have to do with shutting out what's happening in the physical environment and these pervasive and mobile technologies that are enabling media and network communication to move into all kinds of environments where they didn't exist before. So if you look at, say, massively multiplayer online games, then you're seeing an environment where the virtual space is really the primary referent. But there's also things like, I think Pokemon is a very good example of this, where you see gaming and media moving into portable formats that are really meant to be engaged with in social settings and physical environments. And I think that trend is just as strong as the trend towards immersive virtual online experiences. So I think two things are happening, but the overall trend is that spaces, physical as well as virtual, are becoming colonized by these more networked communications and cultural objects that have the imagination or social relations embedded in them. So Pokemon cards enable, if you contrast them to other portable games that kids have carried around with them before, like marbles and things like that, that they reference this incredibly rich media ecology, even though they're just these little cards. You know, they have Pokemon cards in their pocket or their Game Boys and things like that. So when they're engaging with each other, even in physical space and birthday parties and things like that, they can reference this whole other cultural domain through these media objects. And I think that's an example, just like mobile phones, where you may be physically together with other people, but you have access to this whole network of media at the same time.
Are the criteria for personal success changing?
Well, I think yes. I think that we're being asked to mobilize a greater set of media resources in self-expression and telling stories about ourselves and authoring ourselves. I think that's true, and I think that's part of why the access issues are so important, because in the past, you know, if you didn't know the latest television show or if you didn't keep up with the news and things like that, that there was a sort of demand that you keep up with public culture and media and things like that, just as being a participant in information age society. I think that bar is higher now, where, you know, if you don't have a web page, if you don't have a mobile phone, things like this, these are becoming standards of participation, at least for certain communities.
Mimi Ito is a cultural anthropologist who studies new media use among young people in Japan and the U.S. According to the Census Bureau, Texas became the fourth state to have a non-white majority population, joining California, New Mexico, and Hawaii. This week's CityViews commentator Walker Smith examines this growing diversity of the American experience.
In 1980, minorities accounted for 20.4% of the U.S. population. By 1990, it was 24.4%, and by 2000, it was 30.9%. Projections are that by 2030, minorities will be 39.9% of the U.S. population. After 2040, more whites will die each year than are born. By 2050, the Census Bureau projects that whites will no longer be the majority population in the U.S. They'll just be another minority group like everyone else. The largest minority group, but just another minority group. Today, Hispanics are the largest minority group in America, surpassing African Americans during the first half of 2003. Asian Americans, while smaller in total, are the fastest growing minority group, but the growth rate of Hispanics is accelerating. Hispanics grew 13% between 2000 and 2003, over four times the rate for the population as a whole. Already, Hispanics account for the largest part of year-to-year population growth, and the Census Bureau estimates that by 2050, America will be second only to Mexico in terms of total numbers of Hispanics. These changes are economic as well, particularly for Hispanics. In 1990, the buying power of African Americans was estimated to be $318 billion. It was $222 billion for Hispanics. By 2003, the buying power of the two groups was about equal, $688 billion and $653 billion, respectively. By 2008, the buying power of Hispanics is projected to be over $1 trillion, compared to $921 billion for African Americans. This is not to downplay African Americans relative to Hispanics. It is simply to underline the growing diversity of the American experience. Talking about Hispanics as if they were all the same is misleading. Indeed, the term Hispanic itself, and Latino too, glosses over a wide-ranging diversity of geographies, nationalities, and cultures that exist among Hispanics. Even race is diverse among Hispanics. In the last census, 42% of Hispanics refused to check a box for race because they did not think the census categories included their race. So as Hispanics become a bigger part of society, they will make diversity and multiculturalism an even more pronounced feature of American life. In just two decades, the 20th century demographic makeup of American society has shifted in direction. America is changing from a society in which whites completely dominate to one in which whites are but one group among many. Multiculturalism is now the mainstream. The growing presence of minorities changes how people think about everything. Today, difference is the norm. And not just for race and ethnicity. Every day in high school lunchrooms or high-rise office buildings, people see long hairs, short hairs, bald heads, skin heads, buzz cuts, braids, dreadlocks, mop tops, ponytails, beehives, do-rags, headscarves, and more. Diversity of perspectives and cultures is now the rule, not assimilation to a single mainstream culture. The future is arcing away in a multiplicity of directions that will challenge us to update and reinvent our shared vision of the American dream. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to listen to archive shows, sign up for podcasts, and register for our weekly newsletter. Smart Cities web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities, a national network of urban leaders speeding innovation in cities. Information at ceosforcities.org. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee and its citizens. For more information, visit hydefoundations.org. Eric Rudd is our co-producer and engineer. I'm Carol Coletta.